Victorian Periodical Parade.
Hello. I'm back after a super long hiatus. And today, just as a refresher, my buddy Owen, he reads the novels that we cover in this book, and then I read the articles that went along with the novels. Last time, I picked the magazine to read the articles, and then Owen started reading whatever novel we found in there, which happened to be a Thackeray. This time around, however, I'm pairing this with some requirements for my students who will be watching this weekly to read one of their novels as they watch. So we've now centered this installment around the novel we've chosen to read, which happens to be my favorite novel, my favorite Victorian novel, Lady Audley's Secret. It's a novel that made me want to become a Victorianist and inspired me with the love of the field. So we chose the novel, and now I'll be reading some of the periodicals and the nonfiction articles that were published along with it. So a couple of key points to know if you're new with us or if you're one of my students who has to be here watching. Victorians mostly read their novels in what we call a serialized format. That's kind of how, before Netflix, how TV came out. Like, you had to watch weekly to see what happened the next in your show. The Victorians, they would subscribe to a magazine, and then weekly or monthly, that magazine would come out with part of a novel, whatever novel they were publishing that year. Generally, they came out over the course of 10 to 12 months. And yeah, often friends would go in together on a subscription for a magazine. Reading was becoming more and more widespread. People were more and more literate. So people could afford literature in ways that hadn't been previously possible, partially because of the serialization process. It was much cheaper to purchase a magazine than to purchase a bound book. So whereas, 100 years previously even, you had to be fairly wealthy to be able to afford a novel, which 100 years previously in the 1720s was a very new genre in English. They hadn't had the novel in the English language before that. Plug to my students, if you're watching, you can take my development of the history of the novel class in the spring. It's one of my favorite classes to teach, and it's really cool to learn how that genre evolved. But by the mid-1800s, people are starting to serialize novels in magazines, which makes it more accessible to the reading public, who now, is a bigger portion of the population that can read, but maybe not a bigger portion that financially could afford a bound book all of a sudden. So friends would often go in together on a magazine subscription the way we might share a Netflix or an HBO subscription. And that meant that every week or month when their new installment came out, they had to get together to read it because nobody wanted to be left out. Yeah, so that's sort of what you need to know about how these things worked. It's also important to know that because this was happening and because we couldn't just Google things, magazines would anticipate what their readership would want to know about while they read a given novel. So there's a very famous novel that was serialized called The Woman in White, and it has to do with false imprisonment in insane asylums. And the magazine knew that their readership would want to know how that worked and just how common it was and what are asylums really like. So they would produce articles alongside the novel that would answer readers' questions. And not only just alongside the novel in general, but alongside the issue of the novel dealing with insane asylums. They would know, like, that's the issue that we need to have an article about insane asylums. So that's why I'm here doing the nonfiction prose part of Victorian Periodical Parade. This is a media that we don't really have anything akin to it anymore, and yet we are fascinated with serialized media forms. We've gone back and forth on them as we have cable TV and then now streaming media. And I think it's a really fascinating format. That is what I need to tell you about why we'll cover the nonfiction articles. You also need to know that this is a sensation fiction novel. The sensation fiction novel emerged in the 1860s. It was first developed by Wilkie Collins, who was Dickens's best friend. And Mary Elizabeth Braddon, who wrote Lady Audley's Secret, was basically, she wrote one of the other earliest forms of the sensation novel. You can think of the sensation novel like a Victorian thriller or suspense or mystery novel, not quite a detective novel. Detective fiction would emerge much later, although I guess you could say it came up as early as Bleak House, which would be around this time, but truly the rise of things like Sherlock Holmes and stuff is much later. So sensation fiction does tend to have people who are unraveling mysteries, but they tend to be just your average person who gets thrust into this mystery and has to solve it. Sensation fiction was widely popular. It was considered lowbrow, and yet we know that Tennyson, who is the poet laureate, that means the poet to the queen, super highbrow literary guy, he said, "I am simply steeped in Braddon." So even he would admit that he was reading this sensation fiction and couldn't put it down. But it was considered like uncouth. Like if you were really trendy, like you didn't want to admit that you read it. Although I think Tennyson basically had enough celebrity that he could just admit it. But I don't know, like you or me, average folks, we wouldn't want to like necessarily admit that we were reading or watching that. And we might think of it as like how we might respond to like reality TV. Like we might admit to some close friends that we watch it. Like it's not necessarily going to get you kicked out of humanity, but you kind of only tell like trusted people that like this is your guilty pleasure as you read this sort of like lowbrow thing, or you watch this kind of TV that you wouldn't necessarily tell other people. It's scandalous in the form of like being a guilty pleasure or like not cultured. I don't mean that it's scandalous in terms of like being like pornographic or anything like that. It's the way I might admit like I love Teen Mom on MTV. Like it's not what you would think a literature professor would spend her time thinking about, right? It's scandalous in that regard. Particularly it was called sensation because it was thought to make people like have feelings. And so you can imagine if you know anything about gender dynamics in the Victorian era, that was considered very suspicious that like women might be reading this and having very deep feelings. The last thing I'll go over is the London Journal is where this was published. This was not the first time it was published, so it wasn't a brand new story at this time. And the London Journal was middle class. I'll probably go over more about that in a little bit, but I want to go ahead and dive into this article, which you'll see exactly what I'm saying. So the first installment that you read of Lady Audley's Secret, if you go back, if you haven't watched it, go back and watch. There's a man, George Talboys, coming home on a steamer ship, having left his wife, and I don't know if you caught this, but the baby too, she had just had a baby. He left them to go make his fortune. And so the article I found in the same issue that was the same week of the magazine is The Home for Seamen's Orphans. Okay. On the borders of Epping Forest, about 7 miles from London at Squaresbrook, Essex, within a short distance of the Infant Orphan Asylum, stands the building of which we give an engraving, the Merchant Seamen's Orphan Asylum. And I'll post the engraving probably on our Twitter for you guys so you can see that. Because it's a big deal that they would give that the space. It was expensive to do these engravings. So they're really trying to make you think, like, what happens to families that are abandoned by their fathers? Now, you know that this father didn't feel like he was abandoning them. He was trying to go earn money, but one wonders how the mother and infant felt when they woke up to discover that the breadwinner of their family was just gone and they were on their own. Let's see. It's instituted now 36 years ago for the board education and maintenance of the children of deceased British merchant seamen from all parts of the world. The charity boasts of the patronage of Her Majesty, the presidency of Earl Russell, the vice presidency of more than a dozen of the most eminent men, distinguished peers, ornaments of the bench, the bar, the church, and the navy, leading members of the mercantile and shipping interests and of commerce, and the magnates of the city of London as represented by its chief magistrate, the Lord Mayor. Blah, blah. It goes on and on about who supports this. Standing on a plot of ground covering about 7.5 acres in extent, the asylum attracts the eye from its massive grandeur and elegant proportions. Its novelty and its beauty are alike conspicuous, the design of it having been imitated by the architect Mr. G. Summers Clark from the types of the picturesque manorial edifices common to northern Italy. It has a rich ornamental porch, a lofty tower, spacious wings, vaulted corridors, dry cloisters, and airy and sheltered playgrounds, they being at the same time open and roofed. It is built externally of red bricks made from the materials on the ground. The facade is relieved with its Blackwell lacing courses. Let's see. I'm going to skip over the description of the exterior. Okay. As it stands at present, the edifice contains boys and girls schools, a dining hall, boys and girls dormitories and hospitals, officers' apartments, and the usual offices and stores. The boys occupy the south wing, their playground being at the back of the building with dry cloisters in the basement under the schoolroom, and the girls occupy the front facing the west, their playground being in the front of the building. The two sets of schools and dormitories are separated by the matron's apartments and the committee and reception rooms and entrance hall. And then this is something about water tanks. I'm trying to see if we get anything about the history or what people's day is like. Okay. Here's a great, if you've taken my classes, you know the British were very full of themselves and just how amazing they were, even though they had a lot of problems. Though this building was not opened until last summer, it must not be forgotten that the benevolent founders of this institution have, from so long back as the year 1827, been rescuing the children of British merchant seamen from poverty, wretchedness, and vice when disease, accident, or shipwreck had deprived them of their chief support and thrown them destitute upon the world. The few benevolent individuals who established the institution in October 1827 in order to effect their object of providing these destitute children with a comfortable home, clothing, and maintaining them during the most critical period of their lives, giving them an education that would enable them to earn an honest livelihood in whatsoever station their lot might cast them in afterlives, and above all, implanting in their youthful minds the principles of true religion and morality, rented in the first instant a tenement in Cannon Road, St. George. So they're giving that it started first in a tenement building in London. And so it's saying that even though this building is rather new, the organization dates back about 30 years prior. Okay. So then they start asking for support. Let's see. That the asylum is most deserving of support, it is only necessary to know that it stands in the estimation of the British public as high as any eleemosynary institution of the land. Deservedly does it hold this position, providing as it does a refuge and a home for the destitute offspring of men who, as a class, have done so much to raise this country to proud position. Now that's important because the British Navy is what made it able to be such a world power. They had very little in landmass or natural resources to offer that to them. And I should note here that George Talboys is not exactly a naval officer. He just goes off on a boat, but this is still why they would be providing this article, by anticipating that their readers would be like, oh my gosh, what does happen to these people? And not only can they kind of explain that and make people feel like it was worthwhile to buy this magazine, but then they can give a plug to be like, can you donate to this charity? Up at present, the asylum has afforded a shelter, a school, and a home to more than 650 children left at a tender age to battle with the world, its privations, and its sorrows. But though the benefits of the charity have been conferred on so many, the number, notwithstanding, represents but a small portion of those who during this period have been left destitute through the calamities incident to the exercise of so hazardous a calling of the British merchant seamen. Oh, British merchant. So it's not just the Navy. It's also people going out abroad and making money. So it kind of does distantly relate to George Talboys. As the address of the institution says, calculating upon the returns made within the last 10 years, nearly 100,000 seamen have died whilst in active service since the institution was established. And at a very low estimate, founded on the details of cases already admitted into the asylum, it would appear that 150,000 children at least must have been left orphans during the same period. All of these have not, of course, been left so utterly destitute or in such a great state of poverty, even as to necessitate their appealing to this or any other charity for support. But the large number shows that the cases for which the resources at the disposal of management have enabled them to provide represent but a very small portion of those requiring their assistance, which the institution was designed to afford. All right, so there you have a pretty good example. It was short today because I needed to give you some background of why, how these things functioned and what they would have been affording to the reading public. And you can see, you already probably feel like you know a little bit more about this part of society that you maybe were thinking about or wondering about as you read. And certainly if you were living in this time, you would have been wondering about. So that's it for today. On Friday, Owen will read more of the novel, and then next Monday I'll read you another article and we'll continue on that way. Please share with your friends or click subscribe, because this is a fun, spooky activity for October as we go in towards Halloween. All right, bye guys.
Thanks for listening through to the end of the episode. If you'd like to join the parade, browse on over to Instagram at Victorian_periodical_parade or Twitter at Victorian Parade. Feel free to leave your likes and comments there. And retweets always help. Before you go, please rate and review us on podchaser.com. I'm looking forward to marching alongside you in the next edition of the Victorian Periodical Parade. Ha de bra! Victorian Periodical Parade.